I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. Kansas City is celebrating 150 years of Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. Chances are, even if you haven't read the book, you know the story. A little girl is bored. She's supposed to be reading, but she isn't really enjoying it. And that's when a talking rabbit wearing clothes and carrying a pocket watch, of course, scurries by. So Alice springs to her feet, follows him down the literal and proverbial rabbit hole, and that's how her adventures begin. We're joined now by a librarian who can talk to us about the huge influence of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland on our culture. Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning, Gina.
Even just that phrase I used a minute ago, down the rabbit hole, is such a part of our language. Alice in Wonderland is where it comes from.
Yes, among other phrases that we love, such as curiouser and curiouser, and what is the use of a book without pictures or conversations? That one is my personal favorite because I like books full of pictures and conversations, and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is a book that fits Alice's criteria for good reading. But Alice has definitely entered the popular culture, and there are so many phrases and characters that we recognize.
Remind us of a few of those characters.
Oh, well, when I say Mad Hatter, everyone knows what I'm talking about. Dormouse, sleepy as a dormouse. White Rabbit, Rabbit Hole, I'm late. If I say caterpillar, everyone knows I'm talking about this really spacey caterpillar sitting on a mushroom with a hookah. So there are all these cultural references that we have taken from Alice in Wonderland that are so recognizable to us. And it's wonderful how this book has entered the public consciousness.
We'll get into how it did that in some depth, so I won't do that now. But Katie, I'm sure that you're aware that the library is full of books, important ones. So why does this one, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, get a two-month celebration for its birthday when most books are pretty happy just to get read once in a while?
Well, probably because Alice is looking pretty good for a 150-year-old lady. And this is a book that appeals to children, to teens, to adults, to a wide range of readers. It's a compelling storyline. It's a speedy plot. It's cinematic. It's artistic. It's musical. There are so many ways this book resonates with us as readers, and there are so many ways it's entered the humanities across the board. So we've seen Alice in art. We've seen Alice in music. There are so many Alice in Wonderland movies, many, many adaptations, that how could we not celebrate this book that has stayed with us for so many years?
The kickoff event for the Alice in Wonderland celebration at the library is tonight, and the speaker, Mark Burstein, is a Lewis Carroll scholar. He's with us now. Welcome to Kansas City, Mark.
Thank you, Gina. Hi up there in the audio radiance.
What's your relationship with Alice and her author, Lewis Carroll?
Well, it's not personal, although I did once shake the hand of someone who shook the hand of Alice. I've been sort of reading and obsessing about Alice since I was a kid, and my dad read it to me. He himself was a Carroll expert and was president of the Carroll Society, and he started our collection, which now is about 3,500 books.
Whoa. What makes it into this collection?
Just the concept of having, 2,000 different editions of the exact same book. I have 106 languages. We know of 174 that it's been published in. And illustrators are all over the map. It's a fascinating thing to collect. And there is a Lewis Carroll Society, unlike, say, the Jane Austen Society, where we don't take ourselves very seriously. We're a pretty funny group, based, of course, on this novel. So it's just been it's sort of genetic. I got it from my dad, and it's been with me all my life.
So, like, some families go and play golf together, father and son, and you and your dad do what? I mean, set the scene for me as you and your father are enjoying this shared Alice's Adventures in Wonderland hobby.
Well, book collecting is a little more solo than that. In the old days, pre-internet, it was a detective hunt. You'd go to old bookstores and antiquarian book fairs, and you get these letters from people in Bulgaria. I just found this copy of Alice, and it's a total thrill to get this in the mail, I used to be able to go into my dad's library and just point out the three books that he had bought since last time. The internet, for me, has just pretty much sucked the life out of collecting. It's three mouse clicks is not
It's not a thrill.
It's not a thrill. You know, I like the hunt. I like to have a good story behind the books in my collection. It was a nice bonding experience.
So you mentioned that you started reading Alice in Wonderland or Alice's Adventures in Wonderland as a kid. Can you remember how you interacted with this book back then? Just as I think the intended audience, though I'm not sure.
I don't really recall my childhood readings. The times I am most conscious of it was in college. There's a wonderful recording by Cyril Richard on records, vinyl. Actually, it's downloadable these days. It's just the complete reading of the book. And I just used to love to just sit down and let it flow all over me, and ended up writing a large part of my senior thesis on Looking Glass.
So that brings me to this question of your scholarly interest in the life and work of Lewis Carroll. What's at the heart of that scholarly interest? What are the big questions that fascinate you?
I would say I would qualify it much more as the work of Lewis Carroll than the life. To me, he had one of the dullest lives imaginable. He went to Oxford at 18. He stayed there his whole life. He, you know, left England once. He, as far as we know, he... I never had a girlfriend, never got married, blah, blah, blah.
Though people do, if I'm not mistaken, have some questions about his keen interest in this little girl, Alice Liddell.
Which is a total canard. I'll be happy to go into that if you like. But
we don't need to in depth, but I'm curious what your take on it is.
My take on it is that it's cultural relativism. It's very hard for us to look back in those days and say, you know, he was spending all his time with little girls, which actually wasn't even true. What happened was his nephew, his first biographer, Stuart Dodson Collingwood, in order to cover up a little spin doctor on his uncle's well-known affiliation with actresses and other women of ill repute in the Victorian era, said, oh, no, he never did that. He just spent all his time with little girls. And then 50 years after that, the Freudian said, And it's much more a reflection on our age as his. No one ever accused him of doing anything wrong. It just, you know, somehow it's hard for this modern age to believe in love without some sort of, I don't know, sleaze attached.
So he was, in your estimation, boring in real life, made possibly interesting by interpretations of scandal long after he's gone.
No, I don't. I ignore the whole scandal thing.
Okay.
I think it's just it's a red herring. I think although the externals of his life was very boring, if you actually got to spend time with him, especially if there were children around, you know, as a storyteller, I mean, he was just, I'm sure, a remarkably witty and wonderful person. He also, you know, was one of the first photographers. He was a constant inventor. He invented a lot of things. He was an adapter of all new technologies, from typewriters on. He was. I would have loved to spend some time with him.
Well, what is it that captured your interest about his work? I mean, you wrote a college thesis about him.
It's sort of what Katie was saying. I mean, first of all, it's very, very funny. And to me, it captures the actual reality of our lives a lot better than most, you know, narrative descriptions of it.
Explain that. Pick a scene, like a moment from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and explain to me how this captures some universal human reality.
I may have to dig for that one. I just, you know, looking around, let's say at our, not naming any names, but our current political situation, it's very hard to believe that it's not kind of Wonderland. I mean, you know, what we're taught in school about the life, the business, the lawyers, that sort of the brain, and that adult authority is always correct and should be. And here comes Alice and realizing that adults are completely whacked out and that the world is a much crazier and funnier place than it could possibly imagine. I think that's a much truer description. Things every day happen to you. You go, what? You know,
impossible. This is real life. Yeah, Katie Stover seems to be bursting with an example of this.
I love the Mad Hatter Tea Party scene. I can't help but read that and think, I've attended some meetings where it seems as if this is how I feel, like Alice, as if I'm not certain exactly what's going on, and someone asks a question, and then someone answers it, and it doesn't really answer the question, and it's talking about a completely different topic. So for the Mad Hatter Tea Party scene, I think, I've attended those meetings.
That sparks off a response to you. The courthouse scene at the end, the trial.
Remind us what this scene is all about.
When Alice is put on trial, the Jack of Hearts is put on trial for eating the tarts, and there's this crazy jury box. Half of them are upside down. Sometimes when the judge says something, half of them write down important, the other half writes unimportant. I've been, on juries and things, and it's so much more like that than you're given to believe. They're very arbitrary rules. Things are upside down. Sentence first, verdict afterwards. That's a line from Alice.
Yeah. I mean, the memorable lines seems to be a pretty big deal, and that's kind of how I think of this. And then whether it's songwriters or novelists, other people who play with language playing with Carol's language, like Stephen Merritt from the Magnetic Fields, saying, they call me mad and I'm mad as a hatter. Some fall in love, I shatter. That just, there's this constant playing with Carol's turns of phrase. Can we talk about his use of language?
Well, I would say it's unquestionably the most quoted novel in the English language. It's on a scale, if you look through Google, of about with Shakespeare and the Bible. I mean, it's that quoted. He was, aside from puns and turns, he was just a marvelous linguist.
For all of his quotedness, is there an under-recognized and under-celebrated phrase in this book?
I can't think of one.
Well, I would say that as one reads it for the 960th time, you'll always, there'll be something. For me, just the other day, it's curious, this sort of life always being ordered about by mice and rabbits. It's just sort of like I'd never really remembered reading that, although I'd obviously read it before. So things just jump out of you.
Central Standard is off to a break. When we return, Mad as a Hatter, Grinning Like Cheshire Cats, we'll return to Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're having kind of a mad tea party here on the radio discussing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland 150 years after its publication. An event at the library this evening kicks off a two-month citywide celebration. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about your favorite Alice in Wonderland reference in pop culture. Mark Burstein, Lewis Carroll Scholar and past president of the Lewis Carroll Society of North America, thanks again for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Gina. Pleasure.
And Katie Stover with us from the Kansas City Library, Kansas City Public Library. It's always a pleasure having you.
And always a delight to be here.
Alice in Wonderland is probably, as we've been saying, one of the most alluded to stories ever written. Probably up there, you've said with the Bible, and the only other children's book I can think of that maybe is up there with it is Frank L. Baum's Oz series. Can we get a little deeper into why we think that is?
Why Alice or Oz or?
Yeah, why Alice? What? Why?
We were just talking about that. There's a snowball effect. Once something gets into the culture, it's quoted, and then its quotes are quoted, and so on. It's also, as you mentioned, so widely adapted, widely illustrated, widely published. It's just once something becomes a meme in our culture, it takes a life of its own. It goes on.
The concept of going down the rabbit hole, I do think, is so interesting because it's not just that he's given us sort of a metaphor that we can use in language and that we've adopted as a phrase, but it's putting his finger on a concept or a phenomenon that is part of how we understand ourselves now. Now we recognize that we're having moments where we're going down rabbit holes. You know what I mean? That's more than language.
Yes, that is. That's a common experience, and it's one that we adapted when Alice starts tumbling down the rabbit hole, and she's not really certain what's happening, and she doesn't seem to be afraid either. And that's probably a difference in the way we use the phrase going down the rabbit hole, where we're not certain where we're going. We know it's going to be a little crazy and unexpected. But when we use that phrase now, we're experiencing a little bit of fear because it's the uncertainty that scares us. And Alice never seemed to suffer from too much fear or uncertainty.
Fear of getting off track, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, that was a very radical notion for a Victorian children's book, most of which were full of morality and, you know, this piousness and, you know, the good girl always goes to heaven and so on. And here comes this sassy little girl who stands up to everyone she talks to. I've heard
and
it said...
Who tries everything put in front of her.
Yeah, exactly. Who tries everything. Nothing phases her. You know, I've heard it said there are only two basic plots in literature. One is when someone goes on a quest to a strange land, and the other is the opposite, a stranger comes to town. Alice is an example, obviously, of the first, when we go into a new and different land. But when one wakes up, one has a whole different perspective on the normal reality, the day-to-day life.
Do you think that the song White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane shifted the meaning of Alice in Wonderland in our culture? I mean, that's the song that reframes the whole plot as one giant series of drug references with lyrics about how one pill makes you larger, another makes you small. There's a hookah-smoking caterpillar. What do you think?
I know Gracie. She was a patient of my dad's, actually. She told me that she's never read the book. What that was she took some LSD, went to the Disney version of the movie, and came back and wrote the song. So
that's an allusion to an allusion, because there's the book, then there's the movie, then there's the song. LSD gets in there somewhere.
Well, it's sort of an illusion to the allusion. Allusion to the Alice. So she was a little bit off. And, it's good in that, it comes out into the popular culture and people know what it is. On the other hand, like these reference to his supposed fondness for little girls, you know, nobody thought of it in his lifetime. In the 60s, a lot of heads were going around going, wow, man, you know, he must have been on something to write this. Well, no. I mean, what you smoke in a hookah is called shishka. It's a flavored tobacco. It had nothing to do with anything. You know, I'm sure he read about some of these things. But anything stronger than sherry or perhaps laudanum for a headache or something, it really wasn't a drug trip. On the other hand, it fits in beautifully with drug trips. So, I know, just another.
Yeah. I've been telling book groups, we can't read Alice thinking that Lewis Carroll was a drug user for the same reason we can't look at folks who grew up in the 60s thinking everybody was a hippie and high all the time. We weren't. All Victorians weren't on opium. All children of the 60s were not on pot. It seems like it, but it's certainly not. Well, it's an unusual world for Alice. It's an unusual world for us to read.
One of the points in my senior thesis was that this book is so open, you can read absolutely anything you want into it. And that's part of its magic. On the other hand, some people have taken, you know, crazy advantage of it. I have books in my library that prove he's Jack the Ripper, that prove Queen Victoria wrote the books, that prove Mark Twain wrote the books, that prove he was an Orthodox Jew, and all the rituals of Orthodox Judaism are quoted. You can, whatever you want to read into it, you can find.
Somehow he imagined a story that captures a lot of different possible references, and that seemed maybe, there was something about it that maybe seems like it's coded, is maybe why people are trying to look for what it really means. Do you think so?
Oh, I think so. I think that's in there. It's so easy to reinterpret what's going on in every single scene, especially since they seem to just be vignettes that are lightly strung together.
Right.
And Alice doesn't really have a goal going through Wonderland. She's never worried about getting home like Dorothy is in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, there's really no story arc. It's a series of incidents, which is one reason that there's really never been a good movie.
Free association.
Yeah.
Let's
people are scared of the non-rational world. And you know, once you move out of it, you have to think, oh no, and then you start using your little rational brain and, you know, counting the number of letters in this words and coming up with something.
Let's talk to Sherwood in Kansas City, who wants to talk about this whole psychedelic relationship with Alice in Wonderland. Hi, Sherwood.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
You covered it pretty thoroughly, especially when you went into the fact that you can really read anything out of it that you want. But something I noticed is that the psychedelic culture really took it and kind of sustained the story and created a lot more a larger fan base, I guess. And I think that helps sustain it into, you know, still such a popular story today. There's just a giant culture behind it that really looks at it and adapts it through a psychedelic reference and finds that meaningful.
Thanks, Sherwood. That does bring up, too, that I think a lot of people probably, before hearing those other references, might have left it in childhood, thought of this as that book that they read as a kid that might not have so much relevance to them as adults, rehearing it through, say, a Jefferson Airplane song.
Oh, definitely. There's I think the only fairy tale elements that appear in this book, and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, is that scene where Alice is with the milk and the cake and the key on the glass table. I mean, a glass key is one of those objects that appears frequently in fairy tales.
Can you explain what's happening there a little more clearly in case someone hasn't read it recently?
The first room Alice enters after she's tumbled down the rabbit hole, she can't find the rabbit, and she sees this long hallway. There's a glass table with a golden key on it. And she reaches for the key. There are lots of doors lining the hallway. The key fits a very tiny door. She turns the key. She sees a beautiful garden. And that's the impetus for her journey through Wonderland. She wants to go through that door and get into that beautiful garden. She's not small enough. So she puts the key back on the table, notices a bottle of milk next to the key, drinks the milk, makes her too small. Oh, I can fit through the door. Oh, no, I locked the door. Now I can't reach the key, which I left on the table. She sees the cake. Eats the cake. She's tall enough now. She goes all the way to the rooftop. She's tall enough now to reach the key, but now she's too big to fit through the door. This conundrum, which immediately sets the stage for us as readers about how crazy Wonderland is going to be for Alice. All these obstacles.
I've got lots of nieces and nephews right now who are really little, and this makes me think, like, I think this is what life would just be like when you're a really little kid. You would always be seeing things that don't make sense to you, that you don't know what's going to happen when you interact with them, and that adults have seemingly placed there for a specific purpose that's just going to, like, really create some whole new situation that you are not prepared for.
And using objects that seem familiar, and they don't do what you expect them to do. And you don't react the way you thought you would react.
Absolutely. I want to add a book that Katie has in her hands. Up to about 1960, Carroll was thought of purely as a children's author. He was never studied academically. No one ever considered reading it as an adult. After a book called The Annotated Alice by Martin Gardner came out in 1960, it completely shifted the paradigm, pardon the cliche, but suddenly it was an object worthy of study. Suddenly adults started to read it because he showed you that, aside from just, you know, explaining what a cucumber frame is, he really went into the logic and the depths and the amazing ocean of meanings behind this, what seems a simple children's story, and therefore a lot of adults started reading it.
Let's talk to Matthew in Kansas City. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. I was going to comment a couple of things. One was The Annotated Alice, which was my first reading of Alice in Wonderland. Of course, as a kid, I'd seen the movie. And this was back in the mid-70s that I read The Annotated Alice. My father gave it to me. And I was calling originally about the drug references and to note that the author, Dodgson, was a mathematician and philosopher, and that if you get into very deeply into philosophy and even theoretical mathematics, you don't need drugs to see the twists and turns on the world and the way people think and the use of language and the illogic that underlies what we think is a stable, logical world.
Matthew, thanks. That gives me an idea for a new anti-drug campaign and pro-math campaign. Math is the new drugs.
There you go. Could I add, thank you, Matthew, but Gardner revised the annotated Alice twice in his lifetime, and he passed away in 2010. And I was asked by his son to do a new edition of the annotated Alice called the 150th Anniversary Deluxe Edition, which is coming out this month. I think we'll have some copies at the library. I've added or changed 100, updated, I should say, 100 annotations. We've added 100 new color pictures. It's a glorious edition. It's a total tribute to Martin, of course. But I really suggest looking at the new one. It's got a lot of great information in it.
What is an annotation that you had to change? Can you tell me a story of how you learned something new about this 150-year-old text, 150-year-old story that it's taken on a life of its own academically, too?
All right. One quick one comes to mind. There has always been this rumor that Carol had this photograph of a young girl named Mary Hilton Badcock, and that Tenniel used her as a model. In the original annotated Alice, he said there's some doubt about this. Well, we went actually to the University of Texas at Austin, dug up all the family papers. It turned out that her husband was trying to get her in on this. Carol didn't even see the picture until a year and a half after Alice had been drawn. So she had, and as he said to asking Tenniel to draw from a model is like asking me, having a calculator in front of me. It's a multiplication table in front of me. It's just not something he did. So, we corrected.
And that's the original illustrator.
Yes, John Tenniel was the original illustrator, and which is it's one of the great ironies that he did such a perfect job and it's such an iconic part of our culture. And yet it's now become the most widely illustrated book in the world.
What about the many different movie versions of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland? You've mentioned, Mark, that you don't think any of these versions gets it right.
Nothing gets it right. The Disney, the 1951 Disney, it's a cute Disney cartoon, but doesn't really follow the dialogue or plot of Alice. That hairball that Tim Burton coughed up in 2010 has absolutely nothing except the title in common. It's just, don't get me started.
It had some cool costumes.
It had some nice effects. There are things redeeming, but it had nothing to do with the plot or character or anything else. There was one that came very, very close. It was a BBC teleplay in 1966, directed by Jonathan Miller, starring Peter Sellers, Sir John Gielgud, Peter Cook, all the great English comedians, with almost no costumes, no special effects. Very low budget, caught it perfectly, or almost perfectly. I mean,
Katie, do you have any movie reviews for us on our way out? Any of the Alice in Wonderland movies?
I've seen all of the all of the adaptations that Mark mentioned. But for anyone who wants to hear more about the movie adaptations, on Wednesday, September 23rd, Mitch Bryan, UMKC film professor, will be giving a talk on Hollywood Wonderland and doing an exploration of all of, or at least a good many of the Alice in Wonderland adaptations. And I know that we agree that the Miller adaptation is wonderful.
Well, that'll answer that. That's all the time we have for today's show. Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
And Mark Burstein, Lewis Carroll Scholar, this has been fun.
Thank you so much.
Mark will be giving a talk this evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library with a reception beginning at 6.
And tomorrow night at Woodneath Library for Mid-Continent Public Library. The Woodneath branch at Mid-Continent Public Library tomorrow night.
Well, that's wonderful. And you can get all of those details on both libraries' websites. Listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard tomorrow. We'll talk about the ideal teacher of the future. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.